Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
And my guest is Mike Papantonio. He is the author of a brand new legal thriller. This one is called Suspicious Activity. It is available everywhere, and it's just a fantastic deep dive into something that is very real. But before we jump into the book itself, Mike, can you explain to me what suspicious activity, the legal significance of that is in the banking industry?
In the banking business, when something repeatedly comes in and it appears that somebody's making a transaction that might be used to buy drugs or armaments or weapons, they have a scale that they're supposed to use, that every time there's even any thought that it's irregular, they're supposed to report that. And, of course, the biggest case that came up with this was the European banking system, HSBC, where they had washed money for drug cartels and terrorists. They had overwhelming numbers of what they call SAR, suspicious activity reports, where they had just covered them up. They made them disappear. And so all of a sudden they're caught and they find that, yes, they actually admitted, they signed a document where they admitted, Brian, that they had been admitted washing money, admitted that they knew how the money was being used in terrorism and by drug cartels, admitted that they understood that there was a loss of human life because of that, and admitted that they made hundreds of billions of dollars doing it, and nobody was thrown in jail. Not one person went to jail. They were made to pay a billion-plus dollar fine, which was nothing. It was simply cost of doing business. Their number of suspicious activity reports that were manipulated and covered up was in the hundreds and hundreds over years. So it's an important thing. They have to be able to report to the government that, yeah, the people we're dealing with don't have anything peculiar about them. There's no reason that we ought to suspect that they're up to anything that looks like criminality.
Who makes that choice at the bank, whether something is suspicious or not? Is it objective or is it subjective?
Well, it is somewhat subjective, but there's certain criteria. And that is, has the transaction moved through four or five hands before we got it? Where was the beginning of that transaction? How many gyrations took place before it came to us? Was it money that came from an area where we certainly know that there's drug cartel activity? We certainly know that there's terrorism activity. Did it originate there? There's a criteria that anybody with a brain can follow that criteria. And the type of SARs, the suspicious activity reports, that were covered up at HSBC. And, oh, by the way, it's not just HSBC. There are banks all over America and all over Europe that have been brought into suspicion under this. But they, although it's objective, they certainly can use some subjective call. But the bank is interested in minimizing those reports because they're making a lot of money. You know, if you've got a drug cartel. Matter of fact, HSBC actually had a system where they had a deposit system that was specially made for drug cartels, in that when the drug cartel wanted to put $100 million deposit in the bank, they had a slot that they had, a special box that they could actually just insert the box and the money went to the bank that way. So this is such huge money for these banks. It's just overwhelming money that they're willing to take risks, and they understand that there's human life at risk here.
And I guess this begets my next question, is the book itself deals with, the background is the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and it has to do with banks funding IEDs, improvised explosive devices, and EFPs, the explosively formed penetrators. But you would generally think that this is a novel or a thriller that involves the U.S. government going after them, but in your book, it's the private law firm that goes after them. So is this a matter of the government not wanting to pursue this, so private industry has to step in and essentially do what government should be doing?
Well, that's an age-old story. In the United States, for example, we just finished the opioid case, and that book that was written about that was called Law and Addiction. And in that case, you would have expected the government to step in and shut down these companies that were killing 150 people every day for almost two decades. But they didn't. The regulators didn't step in because the regulators were looking for jobs in the industry. They're being paid $150,000 in this, where you say, why don't you come to work with us if you'll just give us this break and we'll pay you $500,000. The politicians weren't paying attention to it because they were making so much money off political donations. And so, in the media, even the media in this situation, the book Suspicious Activity, talks about why media wasn't willing to report the things that were very obvious. I mean, it was overwhelming that we knew what was going on after the HSBC incident. The media didn't report it because the advertising dollars are so big. So what ends up happening is you have private law firms that say, well, you know, government won't do it, regulators won't do it, media's not paying any attention to it, so this is the last effort, literally the last effort. You'll find time after time the Department of Justice unwilling to prosecute these folks because they don't look like criminals. They're dressed up in Armani suits. They have Rolex watches. They have MBAs from Harvard and Yale, and they simply don't fit the profile in the U.S. that we think of as criminals. They don't wear hoodies. They don't stand on street corners. You know, it's a double standard that we have in the justice process. So will the government get involved? Most of the time, if they do, it's very minimal. And in this book, Suspicious Activity, we talk about how that all works. But Suspicious Activity, as you know, is it's a fiction book, but it's all based on cases the case that actually we're handling. We represent 2,700 victims of roadside bombs, where we can trace the origination of the money being washed. Where did it go after that? We can trace it specifically to the Hamas group or the terrorist group that may have used that particular thing in a particular region. So, you know, this is not difficult for the government to get involved with. They simply have not. As a matter of fact, the Department of Defense has not been helpful at all to help these, you know, the Afghan veterans or the folks that have been injured in Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan. They haven't been helpful at all in us trying to prosecute these cases against these countries that clearly fall on the terrorism list in the United States. So, yeah, it's a mystery to people. They don't understand that. They think that the government is always there and they're going to do the right thing. But when you read Suspicious Activity, you start understanding why they don't, all the nuances of how it falls on private law firms to do what the government should be doing.
I'm chatting with Mike Papantonio about his new legal thriller, Suspicious Activity. It is available everywhere. Mike, how hamstrung are private law firms as opposed to the government when private law firms really have the subpoena that they can use, but they don't have the power to get a warrant issued? So how does that hamstring a civil firm?
Very good question. Well, it doesn't. It's a problem in that you can't conduct criminal level research. You can't do the things the government would do. But you're able to find the same material. It's what we do creatively. We can find the documents that tell the story. The documents that exist in the banking, these banking cases, are overwhelming. The emails are overwhelming. When you read the email, it almost looks like, you know, it was just an attitude of we don't care. So we don't really need the government to get a lot of this. We have systems that we've used for decades in handling these complex cases, which is what our law firm specializes in. Our law firm originated the tobacco case in the United States, originated the opioid case, originated the human trafficking case. So what I do is I simply take those cases and I put them to fiction stories. This is the fifth in what we call the Deke series. Nicholas Deke Thomas is the protagonist in those cases. And it just tells the story, the backstory, to where you read something that entertains you, but you also walk away and you say, you know, I learned something. I didn't know this about SARs. I didn't know this about how the government simply stands by and lets a lot of this happen, or why the media won't pay attention, or how regulators are commandeered by the industry. It's not something that the average person is busy. You know, they've got to conduct their lives. They've got to feed their family and pay mortgages. They don't have time to do the kind of research to find this kind of information, but this is what we do every day. So this kind of information is right at the tip of my fingers.
Is there a certain editorial decision that goes into your mind? Because you could very easily write a nonfiction book about cases you've handled, but instead you chose to do it from the entertainment venue of fiction. And so it seems like you could tell the same story in a nonfiction book, but nobody would read it because they say, oh, banking, international, that doesn't bother me. I go to my local Main Street branch. I don't care about banks. So how does that play into what readers take away?
You hit it on the head. You hit it absolutely on the head. You know, you can tell the most horrendous stories in a nonfiction book, but it doesn't draw the reader in. I mean, in a nonfiction book, you have to start every chapter with something that's so powerful that they're willing to go ahead and land that chapter. It's difficult. In a fiction, it's a lot easier. You're creating the invitation to every chapter, right? That first paragraph is going to draw them into let me find out more about this story. So you're able to accomplish a lot more. You know, here's part of the problem, Brian. Corporate media in America right now is dead or dying. I mean, they have no interest in investigative journalism. I mean, there are no more Walter Cronkites or Huntley Brinkies or Ed Morrows. These folks don't exist anymore. Now corporate media has become infotainment. And so we think we can turn on the television and we think we get the story. Well, all you do is get the headline of the story. You don't get the backstory. And so these books spend time in a way that's fiction, but it's the truth is, in that fiction is real life. And it draws you into better understanding. And a real successful book to me, Brian, is if somebody reads it and they say, well, this is the first time I've heard about this. Let me Google this, let me do a little investigation. That's a real success, because then they take it on themselves to learn more about that particular issue. And hopefully all of these books do that. Suspicious Activity, I'm certain, is going to do that, because there's things that people never have heard of.
And I know before I let you go, I have to ask, because this really fascinated the heck out of me. You have one of the biggest law firms and most recognized plaintiffs firms in America. Last week, you started a series, and it had to do with exploring ways to hold administrators and professors at universities accountable for the anti-Semitism and racism the Jewish students face on campus.
Correct.
Where is the line between the First Amendment and the anti-Semitism? How do you draw that line, or is that what you're trying to explore?
Yeah, well, it's a very clear line, okay? As a matter of fact, with the type of case we're talking about here on campus, there's a Title VI standard, and the Title VI standard says that some folks are protected from hate speech. And that means you don't say, kill the Jewish kid. You don't burn an Israeli flag on campus. And there's this specific, as a matter of fact, oddly enough, it's codified. Trump in 2019, actually, it was codified, and this Title VI that is an old, originated in 2004, was just put on the books, but it was never codified. And the language of what hate speech is was never defined. But now it's clearly defined. Anti-Semitism is clearly defined by a world standard. And so these administrators are just whistling through the graveyard right now. They don't have the courage to do what they're supposed to do. They're completely misled by the legal advice they're getting. And it's a disaster for UCLA or New York or NYU or Columbia. It's a disaster taking place in slow motion. So what we're doing is the same folks that handle tobacco and opioids and human trafficking and PFAS, these huge complex cases, they're all paying attention to this now. What do we do about this? And we're trying to find, we have found a solution, and there's going to be a lot of lawsuits filed against these universities that choose to do nothing. Stand by and allow it to happen.
Whistling through the graveyard. I love the expression, and it's a very vivid one. This book, though, is called Suspicious Activity. It is the latest legal thriller from Mike Papantonio. It's available everywhere. Mike, your books are always fascinating, and I thank you for joining me to talk about it.
Thank you for the opportunity. I sure do appreciate it.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcasts. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. We can't